On this week's edition of New York Now, an update on what New York knew about COVID-19 in nursing homes and when. Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio and Bill Mahoney from Politico New York join me with analysis. Then, Republicans still want more information on nursing homes from the Cuomo administration.
Because the sooner we get this investigation started, the sooner we can get justice.
Republican Senator Jim Tedisco joins me to discuss. Plus, Democrats say the state's parole system is stacked against people of color and could use an update. Assemblymember Carmen De La Rosa shares her perspective. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. We got an update this week on the state's handling of nursing homes during the COVID-19 pandemic and the data surrounding that. It turns out the Cuomo administration withheld some of that data for more than 6 months for political reasons. So let's get into it. With me in studio this week are Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio and Bill Mahoney from Politico New York. Thank you both for being here.
Sure. Yeah.
So let's rehash quickly the New York Post story that broke on Thursday evening. Basically, what happened is during a meeting, closed-door meeting with Democrats this week, Melissa DeRosa, the governor's top aide, said that they've had the data since August when they asked for it originally, but they didn't want to release it because they were worried that Trump's DOJ might come after them. Karen, how are people reacting to that?
That just raises so many questions. One, were they obstructing a federal investigation? And also the admission that they had the data and that they withheld it from the public. And was that the real reason why? Or was it because Governor Andrew Cuomo wrote a book, how he fixed COVID, and it would have looked bad for him? And the other bigger question it raises, this was supposed to be a private meeting. One of those Democratic lawmakers apparently went in there, recorded it, and handed it over to the press. What does that say about the trust between the legislature run by Democrats and Governor Cuomo right now? That I found really surprising.
Though, like, I'm not totally surprised by it based on the senators, and I think it was just senators in the meeting, and assembly people, the top health people. We had people like Gustavo Rivera, who is a very outspoken enemy of the governor. I don't think that he recorded the meeting. I have my suspicions. I won't air them here. Bill, how are people reacting to this aside from the obvious?
Well, there's obviously a lot of blowback. Republicans pounced on this, I think, quicker than they've pounced on anything we've seen in Albany since the Elliott Spitzer scandal many years ago at this point. But we saw calls from State Chair Nick Langworthy last night calling on Cuomo to be impeached. Others calling him to resign, saying he's lost all trust in government. Representative Tom Reed put out a statement calling for every member of Congress to join him and calling on the Biden administration to do a full investigation into how New York has handled stuff. And certainly, this was probably the easiest softball tossed to Republican political operatives we've seen in a very long time. And it's not a great place for Cuomo to be in politically. Granted, legally, there's a whole separate question, which we'll have to see how this shakes out. The Post framed this story, as we mentioned, as them withholding this data to keep the Department of Justice from getting its hands on it and looking into them, perhaps.
Which raises...
If you look at the quotes and hear how they're clarifying afterwards, there's a couple different possibilities if you read the quotes, which we don't have a ton of context for where they were said.
Right.
You could read it in one way as, yes, they were obstructing justice, and that would be bad. That could lead to criminal charges. You could read it with some of the other quotes in the story and just kind of read some of the quotes that are being framed as this, as them just saying they didn't want Trump to take to Twitter and harass them for weeks and months and deal with that political headache, which is bad in itself, but that's nowhere near stopping the president from harassing you on Twitter is not, as far as I know, a criminal offense. Yeah, so there's a lot that will need to be sussed out in the coming days in terms of what exactly was said.
They also kind of implied that they were too busy dealing with the Department of Justice investigation to give the information to the lawmakers, which doesn't really seem like that good a reason. It seems like they could have done both. And then I think, as the Post reported, she also said, well, we're busy with the vaccine rollout. But couldn't they just have assigned someone, look up these numbers, go through the data, take it out? They have a whole health department there, which makes
right.
you kind of wonder in light of the 9 people that resigned from the health department, the top epidemiologists, what is the health department doing? Or what are they letting them do?
And a key piece, too, is all these conversations that were referenced in the story, the request from the legislature for the data, a lot of the DOJ requests, these were last August. People began asking for this information last April, May. So this is not like they were asked for this information and suddenly the Department of Justice came calling at the same time. They couldn't do anything. This is stuff that had been sought by the public well before the federal government got interested.
Right. It was not a surprise for them to be asked for this in August. And I believe that was at the time that the Empire Center, a nonprofit, also foiled for that information, the Freedom of Information Law. And I should point out to our audience, FOIL does not require these agencies to create spreadsheets for people. It just requires them to release what they already have on hand. And now they have that data. They got it through winning a lawsuit in court. So it just begs the question, if they had it on hand, what exactly was their strategy here? And I think you're both right. The bigger question for me is where this shakes out legally, just because if they were trying to stonewall the DOJ at the time, that brings up the question to me of, DOJ obviously had some sort of investigation. Is it still ongoing to this day? Is the Biden DOJ carrying it over, and where does that stand?
Yeah, no, that's excellent questions. I think that it just raises so many questions that it seems like there has to be some kind of independent investigation. And as we've said before on the show, if they had just come clean with these numbers last spring, none of this would be happening. But now, because they stonewalled so long, gave so many different reasons, it just seems like we really need to know what exactly happened. What really was the thinking? What is the truth here? Because I feel like right now nobody knows. And as Bill said, it's just such, it was just handed to the Republicans. They were just gleeful. Like within minutes, my email was just lit up with every Republican I've ever, you know, anybody in state government saying, you know, essentially off with his head. Yeah. You know, we got to, he should be resign immediately.
Well, speaking of off with his head, how do you think this plays politically for the governor, Karen, or even Melissa DeRosa, his top aide? Both of them seem pretty impenetrable when it comes to politics, but this might be a nail in the coffin, I guess.
That's a rare slip for her.
Yes.
She's been very professional and, well, I mean, sometimes behind the scenes she gets a little angry, but who doesn't? But, you know, but in terms of just being a really competent, you know, administrator. And so, you know, I hate to say this, but you have to wonder, is she going to be the fall person for that because she is the one that said it? It's hard to say how this plays out. Maybe it'll blow over. The governor's been pretty Teflon through the whole COVID pandemic. And he's been very careful not to answer questions about this. He selectively selects reporters during his briefings. Mm-hmm. And it seems that anybody who's kind of on the nursing home beat never gets their questions asked during, mysteriously somehow, even though they raise their hands in the Zoom, they're never called on. So he's been trying to avoid the topic, but I'm not sure after last night how much longer he can really avoid just giving some kind of press conference or an accounting of this.
Bill, I'd like you to look into your crystal ball for a second. How do you think this all plays with the legislature? Democrats have been threatening to subpoena the Cuomo administration for 6+ months now. They've not moved forward with that. We said they had a closed-door meeting with the governor's office this week. Is this going to push them to do something to provide maybe some transparency, or do you think that they put it off even longer?
This is all changing very rapidly, and there's a chance that whatever I say could be very dated by between the time I'm talking now and the time this airs.
Yes,
a few hours
from
now.
Friday morning. Mm-hmm. I should clarify.
Yeah, 12-hour window, everything could change.
Yeah. But I guess the question is, we'll have to see. It seems like a lot of the Democrats have taken the perspective that if the Cuomo administration voluntarily shares this data in the next couple of weeks, there's no need to go to court and start the whole even bigger headache of fighting via subpoena to get their hands on it if they're going to wind up getting it. And it doesn't seem like they're willing to press too hard and launch a war with Cuomo.
Right.
Another key question is what they do with the governor's emergency powers. Way back the day we had our first case in New York, they passed a bill that basically let him act as a one-man government for making a lot of decisions relating to the pandemic. Those are due to expire in April, and I'm sure it will come up in the coming weeks about whether or not that should be renewed. I have not seen any evidence that legislators actually want to have those powers handed to them. If they have to be in session every single day making decisions about restaurants should close at this time or hair salons in this part of the state need to close, all they're going to do is anger everybody affected by their decisions, and they'd rather just have the governor be the one taking responsibility for any missteps they make.
Right.
But it seems like this is piling up enough where the pressure is increasing, where there will be some pressure for them, and who knows, maybe they'll just let this expire at the end of April, not renew it, not do anything to take them back retroactively, and hopefully by the time May comes around, there won't be too many tough decisions to make about COVID because we'll begin to move past this a little bit.
All right. Well, we do have to leave it there. We're out of time. Bill Mahoney from Politico New York, Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio. Thank you both so much as always.
Thank you.
So as we said, Republicans continued their calls this week for a deeper probe into the state's handling of COVID-19 at nursing homes and the data surrounding that. It's now been 2 weeks since the AG's office released a report detailing the pandemic in those facilities. And as we told you, that report found that choices made by the Cuomo administration may have skewed the data on nursing homes and added to the spread of the virus. And Republicans think the legislature should now hold public hearings in response to that report. They were in Albany this week with Congressman Tom Reed from the Southern Tier to call for a new investigation.
Now it is incumbent upon us, as leaders of New Yorkers, to stand together, to come here, to stand before you, to say the job is not done.
But to hold more hearings, Republicans would need support from Democrats, who hold a majority in the legislature. I spoke this week with Republican Senator Jim Tedisco, who's been at the forefront of the issue. Senator Jim Tedisco, thanks so much for being here.
Dan, it's good to be with you.
Of course. So I think it's fair to say that you've been one of the most outspoken advocates in terms of trying to get more information about the state's handling of nursing homes. But for people watching at home that may not have a family member in a nursing home or that may not be following the issue, they may just not know what you're looking for. So tell me, what don't we know right now that you would like to know from the Cuomo administration?
Well, first of all, it's not only me that's been outspoken. It's been Republicans and Democrats in the New York State Legislature. But most importantly, it's been our constituents, the New Yorkers we represent in Senate and Assembly districts. This rises above politics. Big answer, holistic answer to that is we want to know exactly why this happened. To do that, we have to know the numbers of those who died in the nursing home, those who got sick enough to be taken to our hospital and died, and we need the data surrounding that. Simply put, we've been asking for that probably for 8, 9 or more months, and we foiled for it. We've asked questions. We've asked hearings about it. Why do we need those numbers? To give closure to the family members who lost loved ones, but to make sure this does not happen again on an uptick of this virus or another pandemic that comes around the corner. And it is shameless that we have not gotten these numbers, and we had to sue the governor, and we had to have a judge who said, and this is her words, Kimberly O'Connor, the judge, this was a total violation of the open government's law. You have to give us those numbers, and those have to be given by, I know this interview is going to be shown over the weekend, but they have to be given by Wednesday of this past week.
So what do you do with that data? I know that you said that you want to stop this from happening in nursing homes again, but is this an opportunity for legislation or is it an opportunity for more legal action? I guess, what's the end goal here?
Could be a combination, but here's why we need not only the numbers, and we know it's around 14 or 15,000, hopefully we'll get the exact numbers right now, but we need the data surrounding that. Now the data surrounding that is the day in the date that every one of these deaths took place, from what nursing home it took place. We want to match that up first and foremost with the governor's executive order of March 24th, which, as you know, mandated that individuals who had COVID could not be discriminated against and had to be put into nursing homes. We want the numbers not only in the nursing homes, but those who got sick enough to go to the hospitals, because the hospitals didn't cause these deaths. It was where they got the contagion. Those numbers can lead us to potentially understanding that we can't be putting people who may be asymptomatic, but still are defined as having COVID into nursing homes. And also we want to look at those who are working in the nursing homes and may have had COVID, but were asymptomatic and it said, okay, it's okay for you to work in there. Or it also may be how many people were traveling around, workers from 2 or 3 or 4 different nursing homes, and then were moving into those nursing homes and carrying COVID. Was it the isolation aspect where they weren't doing that properly in nursing homes at that time? Was it the sanitary conditions? Was it the lack of numbers of workers to take care of the patients and keep them from getting this virus? So that is the significance of these numbers. We want to know why that wildfire took place and what part that executive order had in it and a lot of other aspects in that time period.
So obviously that's a lot of information. Democrats are in the majority in both the Senate and the Assembly. When or if we do get this information, do you have confidence that they'll actually act on it? It's been 6 months since they've been saying that they're considering subpoenas to the State Department of Health, and it just strikes me that even if they do get the data that you're all seeking, that they may not do anything with it.
Yeah, there's no guarantee that my colleagues are going to work well in terms of drilling down and getting these answers, but we're going to hold their feet to the fire just the same way we're holding the governor's feet to the fire. They've been asking for these questions. If the only way to get those is to subpoena the governor and the commissioner in DOH, and they don't do it, I'm going to ask them to pass my bill, which is a bipartisan bill with a Democratic assemblyman, several Democratic members sponsoring it, and a lot of sponsors of the bill in the New York State Senate. But as I said, this rises above politics. And let me close by saying this. I know the governor will be embarrassed. He already is embarrassed by these huge numbers. It's not 8,000. It's close to 14 or 15,000. I know it's going to probably impact his record of positiveness and a great effect in dealing with this COVID virus. That does not rise above the fact that the family members deserve closure, and we deserve to get those answers so we can stop this from ever happening again. And we're not going to stop until we get those answers.
Do you think he should apologize to families of nursing home residents who died or were infected by COVID-19? Obviously, last year when the virus started, nobody really knew what was going to happen. But as the Attorney General's report said, there were things the state could have done that could have avoided some of those deaths.
Yeah, I think he should apologize because I think a lot of more lives would have been solved. He spent a lot of time writing books, putting football fans in football stadiums. There's a whole bunch of family members who want to visit their loved ones. He could have worked on a plan for a quick test to give a one-on-one and using CDC guidelines to put them in nursing homes to visit their loved ones who are dying, by the way, not only of COVID, but because of heartbreak, and we've been begging him to do that. There's a lot the governor has to apologize for, and he should apologize. Now, one of the things I think I'm going to be doing is creating a bill that creates a penalty, at least a misdemeanor, if a state elected official, including a governor, violates the open government law. I think that's gotta be a misdemeanor now, not just a violation, not just a slap on the wrist. What this governor has done and the commissioner has done and DOH has done is criminal in terms of what I see it as. So I'm gonna be working on a piece of legislation to make it at least a misdemeanor of a lot of thousands of dollars in penalties and maybe time in jail from someone who covers this knowledge up and defies logic by defying that he really did it, that he didn't lie. He knows he's lied. He knows he had these numbers for 6 or 7 months. He can meet with all his Democratic colleagues he wants. It's never going to change the cover-up he put in place, and that is shameful.
All right, Senator Jim Todisco, we'll look out for it. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Before we move on, we should note that Democrats already held a few hearings on nursing homes last year, and this week they moved a package of bills aimed at stronger oversight of nursing homes and safer conditions to keep staff and residents protected. Those bills still need to go to the floor and pass the Assembly to become law. And speaking of laws, Democrats are hoping to approve a series of changes this year to the state's parole system. They say it should be easier for older and low-risk people to be released from prison on parole, and support for those ideas appears to be growing. Assemblymember Carmen De La Rosa joined me this week to explain. Assemblymember De La Rosa, thanks so much for being here.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course, anytime. So we're talking about parole reform in New York, and a lot of people in New York don't have firsthand experience with the criminal justice system, so they may not be aware of what the state's parole system is like. And you are one of many Democrats who would like to see the parole system changed. Tell me from your perspective, what's wrong with the parole system in New York right now?
Well, I think the basic premise of what's wrong with the parole system is that not everyone has access to it. In New York State, we incarcerate people without the possibility of parole. We also know that when people come before the parole board, they're oftentimes not judged based on their transformation, what they've learned while they've been incarcerated. And they're judged based on the incidents that landed them there in the first place. Understanding that our system of justice is broken and that people of color in this state are disproportionately targeted by the criminal justice system, we know that parole kind of mirrors those disparities with white individuals having more of a possibility for parole. We've seen data that shows that 41% of white individuals versus 34% of African-American individuals or Latinx individuals have parole versus people of color. So we know that this system is unjust. This system disproportionately targets people of color, and it's unfair. So we want to see some changes in that system that is not based on racism and other systematic disparities that we've seen.
So you sponsor a bill that's commonly called elder parole. It would allow individuals age 55 or older to be eligible for parole, to get a hearing for parole. Tell me a little bit about the bill and where the idea came from.
Sure. So it's a bill that's been around. The idea is that if you're 55 years or older and you've served more than 15 years on a 25-year or longer sentence, that you'd be eligible to come before the parole board and plead your case to be paroled out of prison. The idea is an idea that the advocates in the criminal justice realm have been fighting for many years. We've heard from the superintendent at DOCS that even being in prison at the age of 55 renders you a senior because of the lack of quality health care that's available in our system and many of the comorbidities that many of the people that are incarcerated already have. And so the idea is that people would be able to come before the parole board and plead their case for parole.
So why age 55? I know you explained it a little bit, but for people that I know that are 55, they seem very young, and I could see that opponents of the bill may push back on the age. Why did you settle on 55?
Yeah, and I explained a little bit before, but it's basically because of the aging process that happens within our prisons. We know that when a person is 55 years old, if they have comorbidities, diabetes, asthma, cancer, these rates are really, really high in our prison system, and those people will age faster within prison. We've heard this data also being agreed upon by the superintendent of DOCS. And so it's important for people to understand that they don't have regular access to things like dentists or general practitioners to have yearly checkups or even access to good food, which actually we know has a detrimental impact on our health.
You also support a bill that's called Fair and Timely Parole. Can you tell me a little bit about that? I understand that it would grant a presumption of parole to people that may be eligible, but I think that you probably have some better details than me.
Yeah, absolutely. That's basically what it does. They're kind of companion bills. They mirror each other in many ways. It's the ability to have people have the opportunity to come to the parole board, even if they're not 55. So we believe in a system of justice that is restorative. People are incarcerated. They have the opportunity to change their lives. We've seen incidents where people have become actually change agents within prison walls. They're the people that are educating others. They're mentors. And they're actually creating change within the prison walls. And so those people should be considered for parole. And we think that this is a huge part of reforming parole in New York State.
So I imagine some Republicans and law enforcement groups may be against these proposals. They usually side against proposals that make access to parole a little bit easier. What would you say to them?
These bills are necessary because, as I said in the beginning of the interview, we know that our criminal justice system systematically targets people of color. I represent a district in Upper Manhattan that was the epicenter of the war on drugs in Washington Heights, for example, and I've seen generations of men and women lost to the system. Some may argue that some of these people have been handed down long sentences based on policies that were popular at that time. And so in order to right a wrong in this system, we're saying that things like elder parole and fair and timely parole are needed in order to take a look at that individual as a holistic person and what they've been able to accomplish within that system. I would like to think that we would aim for a system of justice that allows for that change to take place and for the person to be able to be brought back into society in order to continue to positively impact the communities where they come from.
So in the backdrop of all this is the COVID-19 pandemic, and obviously we've seen outbreaks in the state's prisons and county jails all around New York State throughout the pandemic. There are about 5,000 incarcerated people who have tested positive for the virus, I believe. How do you think the state has done in terms of handling the virus in the state's prisons and jails? And I understand that you recently visited Fishkill Correctional, which is where one of the outbreaks was worst in the state this year.
Yes, you know, I think that there hasn't been equity in the COVID-19 pandemic when it comes to incarcerated people. First of all, we would like to see a protocol for testing that is more rapid, that takes place more commonly. We also know that when a person, and I saw this for myself at Fishkill, is determined to be COVID positive, they're put in the SHU units, solitary confinement. we don't think that that's the best way to handle sort of someone who is sick. Many of the people expressed to me that they felt like they were being punished for being sick and that they did not create COVID-19. And so I think it is not conducive to the mental and physical health of people that are incarcerated to be put in solitary confinement. And in addition to that, we most recently have had to fight in order to ensure that we get a vaccine rollout plan within the prisons, because they were kind of an afterthought in this process. So I would like to see, you know, Governor Cuomo, the legislature, use more of the clemency powers. If there are people who are facing terminal illness while incarcerated, those people should be given clemency to go live out the rest of their short life that is left for them with their families or in the care of a hospital, rather than risking sort of that time frame being exacerbated by the COVID-19.
All right. Well, we will keep an eye on it. Assemblymember De La Rosa, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Cuomo administration did grant early release to more than 3,000 incarcerated people during the pandemic, but advocates say they'd like to see full clemency from the governor to reduce the prison population even more. That's something we'll be watching, but we have to leave it there for this week. Thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.